This is the beginning of class 11.
Sanshi Bhurki Chushin Neto Shram Vira Vinshi Nyande Nyambadi Sangye Shindu Mitte Uwagi Jogu Nanda Shimla
Freedom.
Yeah, what did? 1357, 1419.
I didn't
write it down here.
Oh.
1991.
No, I think
we got it.
1991, 1474.
Yeah.
That's what I said, wasn't it?
No.
No.
I heard.
So how old was he when Jeff passed away?
1991.
Okay. Anyway, that's correct. Carolyn, literal meaning of Abhi and Dhamma? And Kosha.
Kosha means treasure house.
Okay.
Abhi means,
literal meaning of Abhi and Dhamma? And Kosha.
Kosha means treasure house.
Okay.
Abhi means, path approaching.
Approaching.
And, the Dharma part, I think, means the Nirvana.
It means Nirvana, because Nirvana is the highest Dharma. Nirvana is the highest existing Dharma, especially in this school. Robin, the literal meaning of the word Abhidharma. So don't mix those two questions up, okay, on the homework.
Did you just say literal meaning?
I mean, I shouldn't say literal meaning. That was a literal meaning. Now, what does Abhidharma refer to? What is Abhidharma? How's that?
The treasure house of knowledge that leads to nirvana.
Wait, treasure house is the book, okay? So don't mix up Abhidharma Kosha and Abhidharma. Kosha is the book. What's Abhidharma? What is Abhidharma? People got some pretty weird books out about Abhidharma.
The realization.
Somebody asked you, what's Abhidharma?
The realization that leads to nirvana?
Yeah, specifically.
That's pretty good.
Perception is that. But the last three paths. Unstained knowledge. Unstained wisdom. Unstained wisdom in this school means the last three paths of the five. Which are what?
Seeing.
Seeing.
Habituation.
Habituation. And no more. And no more. So first, seeing is the first time you see emptiness directly. Habituation is getting used to that perception and using it to remove the last of your bad thoughts. And then no more learning is when you've removed your bad thoughts, and that's your life. Then what's the connection between us? Sorry, we didn't quite finish with that. When you explain the literal meaning of the word Abhidharma, you should add one more thing. Okay? It means, Abhi means takes you up to, Dharma means nirvana. But what is that that takes you up to the water? It's Abhidharma. So you have to tie it up. You know, it's not enough to say Abhi means up to and Dharma means nirvana. You have to say Abhidharma means is higher knowledge, and it's Abhi's view to Dharma. So it's a pun. You have to say Abhidharma, Abhi's to Dharma. Abhidharma meaning knowledge takes you, Abhi, up to Dharma, nirvana. You kind of have to tie it up. It's not enough to say Abhi means up to and Dharma means nirvana.
That's for the little translation of the meaning?
Yeah. So there's three parts to it. Abhi, Dharma means Abhi, Dharma. Okay. Meaning, knowledge is the thing that takes you to nirvana. I mean, that's the part. That's the whole point. That's a little tricky. The next question says, now what does Abhidharma refer to? And then you say, unstained wisdom, meaning the last two paths. And there are accessories to Abhidharma. What are they? They are also considered Abhidharma. Can you name any of them? Yeah, there's two kinds of accessories to Abhidharma. Okay? One is real accessories and one are not real accessories. The wisdom you're born with is one of the not real accessories. Nominal. What's another one?
The wisdom that you gain from hearing.
Hearing, contemplation, and meditation, mm-hmm. which all occur before the first path. Okay. So those are also accessories.
Hearing, contemplation, and what?
The three wisdoms. The one you get from hearing, classroom time. Really. The one you get from contemplation. And then the one you get from meditation. The difference between contemplation and meditation is this. In contemplation, you're supposed to be analyzing something to see if it's true or not. And in meditation, you take your conclusion and get used to, meditate on it. That's the difference between contemplation and meditation. In this case. So, those three are also nominal accessories to Abhi. They are Abhidharma, they're not real Abhidharma. What's the real accessory to Abhidharma? Do you remember any of those? There's something that has to come along with that knowledge. Something that must be present with that knowledge. Especially at the path of seeing. Especially when you see emptiness directed to the first thing.
Intellectual understanding.
Not at that time. Must be concurrent. Must be going on at the same time. One of them.
What did
she say? Nah. Especially in this book. Concentration, okay? Meaning those meditative levels, those high meditative levels. Your mind has to actually be in this form. And you didn't learn. James Cameron, you know? Probably just some guy goofing around. Okay, so the concentration, and also the other parts of your body and mind at that moment, your physical body, your other five heaps, the other parts of you that are going on. If you're in the formless realm, it's form.
You talking about accessories to knowledge?
Yeah, the real accessories are the parts to you and the levels of meditation that you must be into before you can see emptiness directly. The levels of concentration that wisdom has to be married to. And that's where you get into shamatha and vipassana. That's the great marriage of shamatha and vipassana. She's late and she's allowed to come in because she called to say her plane was late and she rushed her from the airport. So that's hard. Okay. Every week, right? Okay. So that's what Abhidhamma really is. That's a little bit of a long story, but I want you to say the whole thing, okay? So it's Abhidhamma meaning higher knowledge, unstained knowledge, meaning the last three paths. Meaning you're not anywhere in Abhidhamma until what? Then you count the first two paths. Until you see emptiness directly. Until you see selflessness directly. In this school, you don't even have Abhidhamma until you're an artist. And then obviously the meditative levels that you have to be on, those are accessories. They're not real, they're not the main Abhidhamma, but they have to be around. And then the parts of me. And then not real accessories, but called nominal accessories, are those three wisdoms, and the wisdom you have from birth, and also the books on Abhidhamma. Okay, they're not real Abhidhamma. That's a very fundamental teaching and instruction, that the books are not real Abhidhamma. Abhidhamma is the knowledge. Okay, a good book should have four qualities. Be on the New York Times list.
At least 52 weeks.
Make money from your office. Still well. You shouldn't waste your time on a book that doesn't have these four things. That's the point.
Subject.
Has a meaningful subject matter. By the way, then also on this question, tell me what the Abhidhamma equivalent, you know, in the Abhidhamma Kosha, what is the subject matter?
Stained versus unstained.
Stained and unstained phenomena. Stained things and unstained things. They want to teach you the dirty side of life, of the universe, and the clean side of the universe. That's the subject matter.
Purpose, instead of purpose.
Yeah. You could say a temporal purpose or a short-term purpose or something like that. That's a good one. In this case?
Plant the seeds of selflessness.
Plant the seeds of knowledge that can discriminate between what and what in a student's mind.
What's stained and what's not stained.
We're confused, you know. We don't have that kind of knowledge because we think that some things that are stained are nice. And we haven't probably even experienced unstained things. So it's to give the student the ability to discriminate between those two things. Okay? To plant that wisdom. Third thing?
The ultimate goal.
Ultimate goal. Okay, which is what?
Nirvana.
And then fourth one?
Just to show the relationship between the primary.
There has to be a relationship between the last two. Which is, you should state it backwards, okay? You should start from number three and go down to number one. So how do you do that?
To reach nirvana, you have to have wisdom to discriminate between stained and unstained things. And to get that, you have to
read a book. Read a book about stained and unstained things. Read a book that has the subject matter of stained and unstained things. That's simple. But all Buddhist books must have those four qualities. If a Buddhist book does not have those four qualities, or any book, then it's not worth your time. Your mental... It's the time of your life when your mind is clear and you have time to read a Buddhist book and you're healthy and you can meditate. It's very brief. And don't waste your time on other books. Test your reading material against these requirements. You know? I think New York Times will leave quickly. Something like that. So even the New York Times, don't waste your mind time. I mean, you know, if you got it half an hour, use it for something meaningful. Your healthy time is very short. You know, use the time.
Also for the exam, do you want us to reverse the order?
No, I let it 1, 2, 3, 4, but when you get to 4, explain the relationship by saying 3 depends on 2 and 2 depends on 4.
Oh, that's good.
I didn't mean to reverse it. I just meant when you explain the relationship, it's easier to go from 3 to 2 to 1. 3 depends on 2 and 2 depends on 1. And that's the relationship. But the order should be like John gave. Helen, what's the two basic, most basic divisions of karma?
Motivated and motivating.
Yeah, okay. This is called sambele and sambele and sambele. Sambele means the movement of the mind which motivates you to do something. That in itself is karma. And then
the actions
of body and speech that you do.
Okay.
So one is motivating karma, which is the movement of your mind. It's shifting towards its object. And then the result of that, physical or verbal deed, is sambele. It's motivated karma. The main point there is that you know who's the driver. And you know that any time your mind moves, that's a karma. And that means you're collecting a hell of a lot more karma than you thought. You know, before you thought you were doing a couple karmas a day. You know, really, you did think that. And now you know you're doing karmas every few seconds.
But you can't do much of that.
You have to learn. That's the whole point. One mental slip can cause you,
but how do you
hundreds
you
of years of suffering, according to Buddhism.
But you don't have control over your thoughts.
Oh, yeah, you do if you try. You have to practice. Yeah, you have to practice. That's the whole point. One slip of the mind can cause, according to Buddhism, one slip of the mind can cause many years of suffering.
What's a slip of the mind, Michael?
Think something very, very angry thought or think a very
and if you regret it, how much?
We're talking about it later.
But when you meditate and you're watching your thoughts.
You wouldn't do when you're well rested or well or you're healthy. See, you know, to keep your morality you actually have to take care of your mind and make sure it's not weakened. If you can help it, you know, that you don't allow yourself part of your responsibility in keeping your morality is not to let your mind reach a state where it could be tempted easily. Mm-hmm. And that means, that's the whole idea behind not drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. It lowers your ability to resist. And so does exhaustion, and so does not eating properly, and so does not working. So your morality actually gets into taking care of your mind so that it's always strong enough to resist. Yeah.
So the idea of understanding emptiness is that when somebody yells at us, we choose to say, oh, I understand my karma cause being yelled at, he's empty, therefore I'm not going to yell back.
Yeah. Nice. I like that.
Yeah, there's still...
Sounds like yelling to Buddha.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's still the guy yelling at you in the initial, perhaps, impulsive reaction of like, oh, he yelled at me and I don't like it. And then the thought process kicks in of all this. So you're still the thought, even though you don't speak it, even though you break the cycle of karmic action,
yeah.
You still have the karmic thought ripening as a result of that.
Until you get more and more used to it. And it happens more instantaneously as you get more and more used to it.
So the idea is the only time you really break that cycle is when you don't even have the thought, when you just have a natural thought of emptiness.
It is like that. It becomes so much of a gut reaction that it actually... What your implication is that the reaction of anger is a natural thing.
Oh,
and wasn't something that was caused by your former habit.
Yes, conditioned.
And if you condition yourself the opposite way, you'll never have a moment of anger. But it, you know, obviously it takes a lot of conditioning. And I'll tell you one thing, if you don't work at it, you'll never get that habit. And if you work at it, you'll find some nice results. And if you don't keep a record of your progress, like some kind of daily diary or something that you carry around, I doubt that you can do it. I don't think you can. You have to be a scientist of your own reaction. You have to be this English journalist, this Samuel, what's his name? Chapter. Keith? Anyway, they kept these they kept these stupid diaries, of every thought they had during the day. I mean, you should keep a similar thing of, pick something that's your worst habit. Keep a little diary, mark down each morning what you did. You have to take, if you don't do something on a regular basis and a formal basis, you'll never do anything. You'll never change. I don't think so. it's not enough to go to classes and kind of think it would be enough. You've got to undertake some kind of regimen to do that. It's like exercise. Okay. Who's the turn? Vikai! Here, you can read it. That's a quiz thing. The Abhidhamma school believes that when you do a really good deed or a really bad deed, some kind of cosmic photograph is taken. Like we call it an aura. And that's supposed to be, what it has five qualities, do you remember? Give me any of them. It has five qualities. Yenna Femi Paya, Gera Mega Jedaga, Chua Shinam Jushin Pa, Hini Nami Chenu Jin. That's a famous quotation. Remember
any of them? Nothing to do with the
Bhakcha.
No,
this is first class.
Right.
It's a very unique idea to the Abhidhamma school, to the Vaibhashika school. Nobody else believes it. But I think it's a useful idea. And it is, or else the Buddha wouldn't have taught it, and he did teach it. So there must be some use for it. Yeah. So what's the first one? Yen dan seme hai yen. Yeah, even when you're distracted, okay? Even if you're not thinking about it, it's there. Okay? For example, if a monk takes a vow, on the day he takes the vow, on the moment that the Kenbo snaps his fingers, he has that vow. And then that takes it. That somehow, that physical form formed by him. And even when he's not thinking about that he has a vow, he has that vow. So that's the first quality. Even when you're not thinking about it, you have it. Second quality, yengna semifaya. Semma means even when the mind stops. Does the mind really ever stop? No. Will it ever stop? No. Did it ever begin? No. That's one thing your stuff is permanent. Okay. But it gets to a very low level in deep meditation. Even on those occasions, which means you're totally not thinking about it. It's still there. Okay. Yanga semifaya. Geda mege. Geda mege. It has an ethical component. It's either very virtuous or very non-virtuous. You don't get this kind of aura from doing a flimsy virtue or a flimsy non-virtue. It has to be a serious one. You get it when you take a vow. You get it when you agree to kill animals for the rest of your life, to be a butcher. Those are examples. So it has to be virtue or non-virtue. It continues in a flow, which means if I take my monk's vows here and then I walk outside, it comes with me. It sticks to you, and it continues on like a stream. It's like the slow motion photographs where this thing follows the car. You know what I mean? The light. Okay.
I have a question about that. Does it end at death? Death of the physical body?
And it ends when you lose that vow. If a monk loses his vow, that is gone. That aura, it disappears. Or when a person decides to give up the vow to be a soldier. When he formally renounces being a soldier, it disappears.
Or when you move also.
No, when you move it doesn't disappear. That was the fourth quality. When you move around, it follows you. And number five?
It's made up of
four elements, which means it's a way in Buddhism to say it is physical matter. When you say in ancient Buddhism it has the four elements, what you're saying is it is physical matter.
Does that mean it's obvious to someone else?
No. It means that somebody else must be able to perceive it as physical matter, but not us. It's subtle physical matter and we can't see it. But if someone were on the correct level, like a realized person, he could see it. But what it means is, when you say it has the four elements, then it has the four functions of the four elements. You must be able to affect other things as the four elements affect other things. Give them motility, give them solidity, give them some kind of quality of being able to write them, warm, things like that. Okay, so those are the five qualities of that aura. It's an important idea in this school. And especially in morality, because as far as ethics, we accept most of what Hinayana says, and even the monks' vows are all Hinayana. The whole practice of monks is Hinayana. So we study that, and we study Hinayana. Okay. Next one, Mikhail. Definitions of virtue, non-virtue, and neutral karma. Excuse me. What makes something good or bad in Buddhism? Is it that God doesn't like it? Is it necessary that it hurts other people? Yeah, I mean, that's the gut summary. Okay? Something is a good karma if it brings you a good karmic result later, a pleasant karmic result later. Something's a bad karma if it brings you an unpleasant result later, karmic result. And something is a neutral karma if it brings neither one. Okay? And there's another little part to the first one which you better put down. What was that? Yeah, ultimately it brings you to nirvana. In the short term it gives you a pleasant karmic result. In the long term it brings you to nirvana. That's the definition of virtue. The definition of non-virtue doesn't have that, right? It doesn't have that part. It doesn't say also prevents you from nirvana. Actually it does. Alright. Diane. The Abhidharma school says that when you do a good deed, there are two mental functions that are always there. And they have to do with some kind of shame. There's two kinds. Do you remember what they are?
The shame is not doing a bad deed because of yourself. And then the consideration is not doing a bad deed because of what other people might think.
Yeah, okay. So one is, you have to put in the word avoiding, okay? I mean, the definition is that, Zenba, okay? Rangjitendichene, Nigewa Zenba, means you must put that down. A lot of people just put, you know, you do it for yourself. The definition is negative. It's a negative thing. You avoid a bad deed. You turn away from a bad deed. Because you would be embarrassed personally to do it, even if no one ever found out about it. You're in your own room, the door's locked, nobody's around, and you still don't do it because of self, your own self-pity. That's mokkha. And then chelyu means you don't do it, you avoid it either because it would hurt other people if they found out, or it just actually has a bad effect on other people.
I thought it was more of what they might think.
That's a very important part. That is part of the meaning of that word. You know, it's that, especially for monks, monks are supposed to avoid the appearance of a bad deed because it might hurt others. Other people might think badly of Buddhism. You know, that's part of it. One part is, it's consideration for others in two senses. One is that they would think badly of you. And then secondly, maybe it's something that actually hurts them. You know, like a lot of times a good person will avoid doing something because it'll have ramifications on others, even though it would help him, you know. Then he doesn't do it. So both of those meanings. Okay. Mason, 10 good deeds, 10 bad deeds. Give me the first three. Three bad deeds of body. These you should have like a all money from your room. Really? If you don't, then how do you know? You know, then where, what are you doing? This is your guideline for your life.
My brain went blank.
Okay.
Blank.
Any bad deed of your body?
Kill idiots.
84,000 people. Killing?
Killing
a living
being. Lying.
Killing, stealing, and infection. Those are the three for I used to remember them as kids, you know, KSS. When I was first learning, kids last CIB. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Those are three that you do with your body. Okay. Then four of speech. Mr. Kiley?
The four of speech?
Yeah.
Lying,
yeah.
Divisive speech,
right.
Harsh speech, and idle speech.
Okay, good. Right. And divisive, we don't have a good word for it in English, but you know, it's either true or false, but the intention is to alienate other people from each other. This is Kylie. Three mental ones.
Coveting.
Yeah.
Being happy
when
other people fail.
Yeah, they call
and
it ill will.
And wrong view.
And wrong view. What's a classic wrong view, especially in Abhidhamma?
Not believing in everything.
That's there. There one is. There is more specific. Not believing in karma.
Okay.
The tenth bad deed, the ultimate bad deed, right? The mental ones are the worst, right? The ultimate bad deed is, in this school especially, is to not believe in karma. Because then what? What about the other bad deed? You've got carte blanche to do the rest. You know, if you think you there's no karma, then why the hell be good? You know, just do what you like. Do it, A, what you like, and B, you can get away with it. Those are the 10. Who's hiding back there? Fran. Karma is also divided into three according to when it's experienced. What's that?
In the first one,
yes.
In the next one,
yes.
And then in the last one,
Okay. And that's an easy thing, and why repeat it, and why have it on the exam? Could be on the exam. Probably will be unless the thing doesn't print it. It's very, 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 very important because it explains why life is so screwy. You know, it explains why good people have disasters and why bad people get rich and things like that. I think if you don't have your mind on this division, you could go crazy. And it's very hard to be a good Buddhist. Because you have to realize that much of what you experience is not your fault in this life. You know, I mean, I have people come to me, you know, they have terrible experiences, you know, they have really terrible experiences. And they say, what did I do, you know? And you study the books and say, you must have done this karma. Well, I never did anything like that. And it's true, they never did anything like that, but they can remember it, you know. And I think if you don't keep your mind on this, you can't really be a good Buddhist. It's very hard. You know, once you study the correlation between certain deeds and their three results, which we're going to talk about later, then you can explain, theoretically, where every experience in your life came from. But you never did anything like that. And that can really bother you. That can make you crazy. So it's much easier. And it's not a cop-out to say that you have done it in the past. And it's still very important in the act of purification to examine yourself for any traces of that kind of deed. Okay. I had a lady who was telling me how she got molested when she was a child and how it ruined her whole life. And many people are like that. There are many people like that. And you know, on the Abhidharma, I mean, according to the laws of karma, it would have been some kind of sexual misconduct as she did in the past. But she was too young to have done any sexual misconduct. You know, so, and then the person goes crazy trying to think of why this would happen to them. I mean, people's lives are ruined at age 3 by some event like this. And I think it's very important to recognize these three divisions of karma. Yeah. We're going to talk about it tonight. So it's not like I'm going to say fourth year, right? That's my usual answer.
Second hour.
After the break. If you don't die from the tea, you'll be all right. Okay. This next question is one that nobody got right in the homework because it wasn't phrased very well. And
I
know you can't see that. Okay. And I said, give an example of a deed of body, and a different example of a deed of speech, and a different example of a deed of mind, and give me the three results. Okay. So, for example, in the first one, you could put killing. The deed could be killing. And then I'll say, what's the first result? That's called numbing gijibu. That's what we call classic karmic result. What is that? It's one of the three lower births. Okay. So the answer for all three, for the first part of all three, is it gets you one of the three lower births. That's the main numbing kijibu. That's the main cooked result. Okay. And then the second one is what?
Personal.
Yeah, you could call it a personal result. The literal word for that is a corresponding result. Somehow similar to the cause. And what is that? That has two flavors. And by the way, you always start the line by saying, and even if you were born as a human, because the last two take over this, even if you were born as a human, Right? Because first one you already said you take a birth into the universe. And then you finally get to human, or you're born as a human, and then what?
You die young.
You have a short life, you live in a country like, it's amazing. Things in India don't work. Penicillin doesn't work, you know. People take tetracycline and they still get stuff. And it's weird. The food doesn't, you eat all day and you get skinny. The food doesn't help. It's weird. I mean, the whole country. You go to Thailand, it's on the same latitude, same parallel, same dirt, same soil, same everything. And everything gets you fat. I don't know. It's really strange. It really is something strange. So, what was the second personal reason? You have a liking. What do you call it? You gravitate towards that sort of thing in your next life. So some kids that you knew in high school were cruel. You know, they liked to kill birds. I remember one guy. You know, and some kids were just naturally very pure. You know, and they loved to help people. And where did they get this from? Where did it come from? So that's the second part. So if you're going to give a good answer to number two in each case, give me, you know, a personal result like, you know, I don't have much money because I stole. And then, secondly, I like to steal. I kind of attracted the idea of stealing. You know, those are the two. Third one is what?
Environment.
Environment from killing what?
Living.
You live about 39 and 90. Well, you can get killed when you walk out. I asked the people from Jersey, they don't want to come to class because they're afraid of this one body. Of course, we're in New York, so we don't care.
We're afraid of going to Jersey.
All right, so that's all. You answer that way, I'm okay. Okay.
It's not clear to me the idea of the taking a lower rebirth or a higher rebirth, which actions lead to which. Is it
projecting karma, right? Oh, which
well,
of
this case,
necessarily causes lower rebirth?
Yeah, in this case we're talking about...
They don't have to, obviously. They have to be of a certain strength to do it. And a lot depends on the last moment of your life. You know, your thoughts as you die.
So when you're saying you're selected through
that... They say in Tsongkhapa says, you know, it comes from doing it over a period,
right.
You know, constantly.
So in this case, when you're saying select a bad deed and what it will result in, I mean, we're
yeah,
just going to lead to a little rebirth.
We're talking patterns. We're not talking like one specific case. The first result and the second result are contradictory if we're talking about the first. Okay. Who are we up to? Mr. Davis, I like this question. This is philosophical. I bet you can answer it anyway. According to the mind-only school, what are you really looking at when you are looking at the sense power of your eye and of the outside object?
It's a concept, a conceptualization, or it's a flowering of a pre-existing seed.
Mind-only school. Mind-only. Guess from the name of the school. Guess
from
the
mind.
They say that you're... It's
it
like
exists. There's in the center, in your mind, there is a storehouse consciousness which projects this image that you're seeing.
They say almost very, very close to it. Okay? They say that it's like a you. And here's your mind, and here's the object of your mind. And they're actually the same stuff. It's just the mind curved around. And you're looking at your own mind, and that mind is appearing as Eric Davis to me, and my eyes are here. Even my own eyes I take to be part of outside of my mind, but they're all actually made of my mind. But you don't have, you know, Prasangika says you do exist out there, but you're my projection on certain data. But mind-only school says no, it's more radical. You are my mind. I never got past this skin right here, you know. you were never ever beyond that, you know. And you're just in my mind, and you're part of my mind. And the reason they give for that is a good reason and accepted by everyone, which is that the seed that creates the appearance of you for me, and the seed that creates my mind to see you, it's the same seed, the same karma. I love that. I think that's great. One karma which creates the appearance of the object and also creates the eye which sees the object. That's where they're coming from, and that part is okay. That's true.
Say that again.
One karmic seed creating the thing you're looking at, and the eyes you have to see it, and the mind you have to think about seeing it. One karmic seed is creating all three simultaneously. And that has to be that way. I like that. That makes sense.
Why do you
if he's only a projection of my mind.
Why do you distinguish those things into three different things then? I mean, what makes those three different things different?
Oh, there's a time lag, for example. The object exists a millisecond before. Then just perceives, senses it, and then the mind perceives that. And so there's a 3-second time lag.
And
you're
like saying
that.
The interpretation.
You're mixing up processing defects.
Okay. I mean, that's what my part said.
Okay.
That was really.
You're right?
The object exists in a nanosecond before you look at it, which is what we had with that glass of water.
You're always a nanosecond behind.
Could you?
Your perceptions are always a nanosecond behind.
It exists because I have projected it a nanosecond earlier, but I only perceive it a nanosecond later.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Give or take a nanosecond. All right. It's like the light of the stars. Some stars have actually gone out and we're still seeing them. The light hasn't gotten to me yet. Okay. Something like that. All right. Damn it. We got a hard one. All right. Three things about mind-only school. We're talking about how a mental seed from a karma is planted. How is it planted? Where does it stay? And how can that seed hang around for the million years it might take for it to ripen?
After you do a deed, for instance, yelling at your boss, the energy gets, right after you completed the deed, the energy gets transferred to the box chalk, which gets stored in the
kunshi.
As a box chalk. It gets stored in the kunshi, and then it replicates itself over and over again, like a still frame from a film. And then it eventually flowers and just yelling at you. So then it flowers to you yelling at somebody else? No, wait. It flowers.
No, if you yell back.
Oh, wait, you yell.
Let's say you yell back. Yes.
Somebody yells
at you.
I think that's a terrible example of a boss, because I always think of a boss yelling at you. I don't think of you yelling at the boss. That's what I mean.
All right. I get it. You yell at the boss.
Okay, so you yell at the puppy, and then it replicates itself, and then...
I knew there was a reason you was around. The only thing to add is, and this is very important, seeing yourself yelling at the boss, okay, is the main thing.
So wait a minute. I was just thinking about, like, bad deeds. I mean, it seems that most of us don't do too many really bad deeds consciously. Like, most of the stuff that you do that isn't too nice, a lot of times you don't realize how bad it is, and then you think about it 5 years later and you go, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And so how does that affect all this if you're not really conscious of it at the time?
She's Sabhajora Tattu. We'll get to it. Well, that's the reason for the distinction between a karma and a karmic path. And the karmic path has to have those four elements present. And if one of them is incomplete, like one wheel on a car, you know, still you can get somewhere, but it's not going to be very powerful or very far. And same thing on a karmic path. If you need one of those four, like if you don't identify the object, you really didn't realize that you really thought that animals couldn't feel anything. And they didn't mind having their skin stripped off. Then if you really believe that, and a lot of people do, they really believe that animals can't feel anything, then it's actually less of a bad karma than if you're really aware of how bad it hurts them.
Well, let's take an example of, like, to a person, where maybe you did something, you said something that wasn't nice, and maybe on some level you kind of knew it, but your negative emotion was so strong that was stronger than your desire to be nice to the person. So it's not exactly like you thought you were being nice, but you know what I mean?
No, then it's kumo. Then the element of sampa, the element of thinking is not complete. We're gonna get to that. We'll talk about that. But basically, when you're thinking about those questions, think about the idea of a karmic path with those four parts complete. And if the four parts are, if something is defective there, if something is less than whole, then the karma is much less.
Yeah. Whenever you talk about the Bokchok being created and streaming for millions of years, you know, you're saying that the energy doesn't dissipate. This is, you know, some energetic thing that doesn't preserve and doesn't dissipate. You know, it's said, like when you yell at someone, the energy runs out and it turns into a Bokchok. So I don't understand how, like, the activities of generating the karma runs, the energy runs down, and yet
yeah,
the Bokchok maintains and increases.
It's the question, there's two things going on, okay? I remember having this argument with my boss like 12 years ago in the back of a car. And he said, your obsession with impermanence, or that things are always falling apart, this Buddhist idea is incorrect. What about a muscle? The more I use it, the stronger it gets. You know? So that's, you have to view it in two play, in two dimensions, you know. As the muscle appears to be getting stronger as you weightlift, you know, it's actually approaching death. You know, it's moving, it's going up, but it's reaching this axis faster, you know what I mean? It is going up. It appears to be getting healthier. And a company which is growing appears to be not, appears to be growing rather than being destroyed. But the longer it lives, the closer it is to its destruction. The longer it gets stronger, the closer it is to its destruction. So that's an illusion. So here it's the opposite. The seed is actually getting stronger as time goes on. But it is being destroyed in the sense of getting closer to the flowering of it, and that's the moment when it's destroyed.
Where's the energy coming from that it becomes stronger? You know, this is this energetic seed which is streaming on, and yet it's increasing in potential. How does that happen?
They say a lot of factors. What makes a seed healthier than other seeds, you know? It's the sensitivity, it's the secondary cause. The fertilizer, the earth, the water, and the sunlight. Fertilizer, earth, water, and sunlight. And then what's in your mind that would keep those seeds fresh and healthy, and, you know, what keeps them from rotting? Mainly ignorance. Mainly the misperception of objects.
So you're saying if you change your mind, those seeds would...
They don't disappear, but they become, they call it like rotten, or unable to produce their results properly. And that's, we're going to get that, the purification process is just that. The seeds are there. How do you deactivate them? How do you make them rot in your brain and never flower? That'd be nice.
I have a question about Janet's question. When we hear about, let's say, a psychopathic killer who is defended by the defense of being temporarily insane. Now, can we assume that he goes through a complete karmic path with those four parts, or that he goes through it and he doesn't know it?
No, it's not all complete, because we also say insanity is a defense, because he's not having his sattva, you know, his motivation, his perception of the events is all defective. It's not complete. It's as if you machine gun a corpse in a bed which he didn't know was dead already. Yeah, he's in a similar situation. And we believe that because of certain factors like extreme grief, that a person can actually go temporarily crazy, misperceive objects, and do something bad, and he's not as responsible for that.
So extreme disassociation
yeah.
would be the same thing?
Yeah. Somebody didn't like that because, I mean, like Hitler getting less of a payback for his deeds than he would have if he really thought that all those beings were nice, you know, people who deserved to live. He had this misperception, and actually it would make the karma a little bit lighter for him. You know, or my father, he thought that animals couldn't feel anything when he went fishing. He really believed that. So actually his karma would be a little bit less, not much.
I mean, it strikes me that we're all in this class, you know, trying very hard to know what we did, what we're going to do, you know, what will happen. And there are a lot of people that you talk to on an everyday basis who don't know. When you ask them a question, they don't know.
No, the more you know, the more dangerous. Seriously, the more you know, the worse the karma is. Much worse. Maybe you don't want to be in this class. Yeah.
I know we had that immediate life and, you know, those things about when it plays out, but, I mean, it seems like something, what is it that makes the Bokchok...
Many people ask me that. It's a queuing process. you know, computer printing. You know, whoever sent the printing job in first, they get the first thing out of the printer. Unless there's this program where you can shove it ahead, you know, in the queue. And the same thing. Deeds done with those peculiar aspects. Extreme rage for the very holy object, or you torture the guy as you kill him. Those all move it up in the queue. So you must experience those first. That delays the other ones.
So you're always going to experience lesser ones, less further on?
The more powerful ones first. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't mean that the next birth might be much longer and more painful, because the same power to maintain a human life, I mean, the power, the megabytes it takes to maintain a human life and the amount it takes to maintain a hell life, it takes less energy to maintain a hell life. Smaller bad deed can get you more time in hell than a very powerful deed can get you a human life. That's just in the Abhidhamma, in the third chapter at the end, they describe how time slows down for those things. They have a different perception of time. A day here is a month for them. You know, things like that. We better, you can ask questions, but you gotta stay till 9:30. It's a deal?
But how does the energy...
Don't get mad at me, though.
How does the energy actually move then once you die? How does it then move to the next life?
That's where you get into what stores it, you know? And that's why you have to say, on a gross level, you have to say the flow of the mind, which is actually just a replication, as is the dhaksha. But on a more subtle level, it's the flow of your perception of the mind. And that's the process you can do. And that takes some time to study. It's not the flow of the mind, it's the flow of the perception of the mind. And that's where the process is. And that's the most important.
So you said, very briefly, the most important thing, or the thing that's very important to understand is it's your perception of what you're doing.
Yeah, and I should go back to that. What's particularly important is your perception of yourself yelling at yourself. Your dog. Alright? And you should mention that. It's the perception of yourself doing it that is paramount. And that's why intention is so important. But it's the actual perception of what's going on. Naturally, a mental event, which causes the bhakshak to be planted, the karmic seed to be planted. And that's why the result is a perceptual event, isn't it? It's a conception. It's thinking you're seeing yourself being yelled at.
Okay. So if you think...
Which is equivalent to being yelled at, by the way. Except that you can change the second one and you can't change the first one. Sorry. If it weren't that way, you could never stop being yelled at.
So if you
and
think...
That's Nagarjuna's obsession. People should know that.
It's this.
Yeah, I said the perception of getting yelled at is equivalent to being yelled at. Mm-hmm. But if you only understand it on the level of just being yelled at, you'll never be able to change it.
So the perception being that understanding where that's coming from,
yeah.
Is that
what
you mean?
Okay. No, partly. But if it weren't just a conception, it could never change. If it were actually an outside event the way it looks like, it would never change.
So if you perceive...
If it's a conception, you can change your karma, change your perceptions, and then make changes. You never achieve any... You never achieve anything you want to happen in the universe. You know, nothing in your life is going to happen the way you want it to happen, except that it happens to your past karma. There's no willpower involved. There's no manipulation you can do of your world which will bring anything to you that you wish, except to be good. And that's profound. That's the whole idea. That's why sometimes you try something and it works, and sometimes you try and it doesn't work, because that's not what's causing it. And that's the proof of it. Okay, anyway. Yeah.
If nothing can come to you through will, then how can...
Well, I mean, you can will to change your deeds and then therefore change your perceptions. But what I mean is, it's will to change, and then you get this understanding to be good, and then you be good and you get your results.
So then there's no will in it. I mean,
that is will. That's all will ever was. But that's good enough to be will.
So it's not really will.
What do they say? They say, good luck, you ever know, you ever go to it. Because something is illusory, because something exists in illusion, it's enough to say it exists. Think of it, maybe not, maybe not, sure. But because something doesn't exist, ultimately it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. That's very beautiful. If something exists illusory, we can say it exists. If something doesn't exist ultimately, we cannot say it doesn't exist. We get in trouble. Okay, anyway, we gotta go on. We know. I think we're back up here at Cranny. Mind-only school says we are right because the Buddha said in many places that the universe is mind, it's made from your mind only. What did the Buddha really mean when he said the universe is mind only? What did Shantideva mean when he said hell was not, what did he say? He says hell is not put there by Acme Construction Company. Hell was put there by your mind. You know? And then what did he mean?
That there's no creator.
Yeah, there was a negative way and a positive way. Negatively speaking, don't blame it on God. Mm-hmm. Positively speaking,
that mind is greater than matter.
Yeah, that mind is the main cause. It doesn't mean everything is made of mind. That's not what the Buddha meant. Mind, especially in the form of ignorance, not understanding all these things, is what creates all this. All right. That question is the most holy question I think. No, I think it's the most holy statement in Buddhism. I really do think that. So I give Tom Crowley to be good at this. Maitreya, in his work called The Higher Line, describes six different steps in the process by which the tendency to grasp to some self nature causes karma and therefore the world of suffering life. So where does this all this screw up come from? That's the thing. Six steps. Mr. Kylie, down there. Six steps to where this whole trouble comes from. Where does suffering come from? Remember? I don't mind if you look.
Well,
that's
nice.
I'm just trying to get you out of doing it.
Yeah, I'm right there. The mental seed from past lives.
Okay, so mental seed for ignorance. Okay. The mental seed for ignorance. That's the beginning of the beginning. Okay. You carry a mental seed for ignorance. By the way, this is different from a karmic seed. That's number one. Number two?
The tendency to grasp to the self nature of myself as a person that exists.
And something else. Me and mine.
Of myself. Yeah, me and myself.
Me and mine. Two kinds of ignorance. Ignorance about me and ignorance about my parts and my things. They start. So the seeds start them. Therefore, amoebas have them, kids have them, turtles have them, everybody, you know. According to Madhyamika Pratipada, every living being has them. I mean, non-Buddha. Not our house.
Is that a stage of aggression?
Yeah. Because in a sense, they're all objects of your eye consciousness and your ear consciousness. I used to wonder about that. Number three, kind of. But mainly parts to your personal stuff. Number three?
That we see things backwardly. We think that things that seem to be pleasant to us really are unpleasant objects.
That's not cardiac. That comes next. Okay. But we perceive things as pleasant or unpleasant. Is that wrong? Mm-hmm. Is that a misperception? Is that a tema?
No. Yes.
It's a promise. It's a tema. It's a correct perception. Some things are nice and some things are bad. The third step here, the third part of the process, is not thinking some things are nice and some things are bad. They aren't bad and nice. They are. It's what?
They're self-existent.
How they exist.
Yeah. It's misunderstanding how good things and bad things exist. It's not the perception that some things are nice and some things are bad. They are nice and bad. Were you going to go out and eat a rock instead of a donut, you know? I mean, that's not a crazy thought. That's a similar. You don't want to eat rocks. You don't think good.
So what's the confusion?
It's to think, it's to perceive a good thing as self-existent, and to perceive a bad thing as self-existent, which means to not understand what you care about. And then what?
And then the desire to avoid unpleasant experiences and the desire not to lose pleasant objects or experiences.
Yeah, ignorantly. Please add the answer. Okay. Ignorantly. Is it bad to want nice things? Well, then the Buddha never would have become a Buddha. Because he worked for 213 countless eons. You know, he must have had that. It's nice to work for good things. It's nice to want good things, and it's right to not want bad things. Well, you would never be a Buddhist, because you're here because you want some happiness. But to ignorantly, you don't understand their nature. So you think the way to get something good is what?
Get it.
Yeah, you know, keep the money for yourself. That's the best way to get rich. When you give it away, you just your bank account's going down. That's crazy. That's ignorant wanting. Okay, number four. Five times.
Karma, the accumulation from your beliefs.
Yeah, then you can collect karma. Then you can actually withhold money from people and think that that's getting you rich. And you're actually doing the opposite of what you should do to get rich. And it seems to work, doesn't it? For a while. And that's there's the rub, you know, that's the problem. That's coming from a former karma. Some people try to save the money and it gets worse. That proves it doesn't work. Another thing.
And then you're suffering in samsara because you do not understand the emptiness.
They just say korwa la kor. That's korwa la kor. Circle in the circle. Okay. That's all. That's all the sixth one is. Then you suffer. You have to. But specifically, you should say in the English, what's the word? What do you mean? When something you do makes something go on?
Perpetuates
itself. That's the word. That's how you should say in number six. It perpetuates itself. But that's exactly the problem. The natural reaction causes it to perpetuate itself. And you know that. Okay. We're going to have trouble finishing it. Maybe I should just let you study all the rest of this thing. Who are we up to? Okay, this is a little bit hard one. This is a question that was unclear and it was fuzzy on your homework because it was fuzzy for me too. And I got a little bit better understanding now, but I think you got to work on it. How does Madhyamika Prasangika explain it? When a person comes into a room and he sets down a glass of water, and then you get a hungry ghost, and you get a hell being, and you get a human. What do they say is going on there? One being sees water, one being sees blood, one being sees ambrosia. What's going on there?
Well, there's a material cause that is wet and flowing, and there are three parts to the wet and flowing that are what each one of those different beings has the bhakchak to see. And so that's what they perceive.
That's how they explain it. And why they have to say it, and I'll do it a little bit more, but why is it important to say three parts? It was a reference to pramana, to tema. You know what?
Because...
they're perceiving different things.
They have to be seeing different things. They have to be seeing different things. You cannot have three tema towards the same object which are contradictory. That's impossible.
How do you say the three parts? I mean, it sounds like made up.
The three parts is not the emphasis of the three parts is not at the time of the perception. The emphasis of the three parts is at the time of the cause of the perception. The moment before they all sit down. Okay. At that point, it has three parts. When they sit down, it has three parts. Did it have three parts when the guy came in and put the water on the table? No. just before they come in and sit down.
You're saying the wet and the flowing has to be.
Yeah.
But you're saying that the cause was
the material cause, the stuff that turned into blood, and the stuff that turned into ambrosia, and the stuff that continued being water, was liquid. There have to be three distinct parts, pieces of liquid that become those three things. The moment before they come in, there has to be three parts of the liquid.
So there could have been 25 parts. There's 25 different things.
Absolutely. And if there was 8 million people in New York, there'll be 8 million parts of the Empire State Building.
But then what does that mean to say that? If it's infinite number of parts, then why does it, then how is it a part?
You could have infinite number of parts.
I think a part.
You could have infinite perceptions of.
Yes, but a part implies.
You could have infinite number of parts.
I think a part.
You could have infinite perceptions of.
Yes, but a part implies a part.
Well, I don't think of it as a physical part so much. If you want to think of it as.
When do you like use the word like attribute or mode that more than a part?
They say part, and then they say part, and they clarify it in the reading if you read it. Part in the sense of arms and legs and a head. It's pretty specific. It doesn't mean there's a glass of water and there's three appearances or something like that. They're trying to say that it's not that.
But wasn't there some...
That A prioritizes that there's a glass of water. And there's not. Yes.
Wasn't there some discussion about it not being the kind of part that obscured? That one part
that
didn't obscure another part. So if it's physical, how can that not be? Because plus it's pus and blood is certainly obscured.
That
water.
Came from a... Somebody came to Dharma Chandrakirti and said, didn't you say before that it wasn't this kind of obscuring thing? How could you complain about this Hindu school that says, oh, all objects have all qualities? And then there's a karma creates a screen, and you only see one part. That stuff is blood, pus, water, and ambrosia all at the same time. And the human's karma screens out the blood and the ambrosia. And then Chandrakirti is saying, that's the idea. That's what he means by that.
In class, didn't you say that you could visualize this glass of water as it had only three beings looking at it as having something like interleaved molecules, so that each side was...
There's a conception of the sense of that. There's a conception of the sense of
that. But didn't you say that there wasn't more of a...
And that becomes reality. That is reality. As much as the guy is bad, and bad to you and good to the black. No. I don't mind. I can say that.
I did a lot of thinking about this also, and I'm wondering, could this be a situation where the object sort of has different facets to it, and depending upon the perceiver or the being, their capability is such that they pick up on certain facets while not being able to pick up on others. If I look at a flower, I see a flowery object that's red, with a dark center to it. A bee looking at the same flower, because they look at things with infrared light, to see something yellow with a white center to it, for instance. And it looks flowery also to the bee. There, it's a bee, I'm a human being, we see a flowery type of thing in a very different way. Same object. It's something like that.
He discusses that. He says, what about a microbe in the glass of water? His perception of the water and the human's perception of the water. But because one perceives of the water as home, his conception of the water is as a place to live. And the other has a perception of the water as something to drink. And he says that's not quite the same thing. And you can read it. It's at the end of the reading. And he says those are not contradictory tema. The perception of a bee and the perception of a human of the same object as being red to this wavelength catching eye and yellow to that wavelength catching eye, those are not contradictory.
But I'm saying, it seems to me that if by a slight extent...
four parts to a karmic path. Carolyn, she suffered or something.
For the complete path?
Yeah.
You mean?
Complete path meaning a nice big ball of karma. Really powerful. Anything missing is not quite a
correct
big ball.
Identification of the object?
Well, for the object.
The intention.
That's the second part. Object is the is what? In the case of killing. Living being.
Oh,
yeah, Buddhism personally extends the bug.
Oh,
it does, actually. The word extends the bug. Okay, living being is the object. Then what?
Intention.
Then what's called the thinking. I translated it as thinking or thought because it covers a lot of different things that we're going to get to later. Third one?
Undertaking.
Yeah, undertaking. You pick up the knife and you go after the guy.
Completion.
Completion, which is what? In this case.
Being dying.
When he died. Jorwa is the dying. As a result of your Jorwa. As a result of your undertaking. And then the second one has three parts of its own. What are those? Carolyn.
Intention.
That's number two. What's the first one? Actually, number three. First one was identification. You see him for what he is, as a living being. You understand he's living. And we talked about some of the things that animals don't feel anything, but they're not a sentient being, and it's okay to kill them. Second one?
Bad thought.
Bad thought. You know, are you under the control of desire, hatred, or just stupidity? And number three?
Motivation.
That's the motivation. Which means, I want to kill him. And that's what's not complete when you run over somebody in a car by accident. We're getting there. You. Okay. Robin, what does geta, most basic virtue, refer to?
It's the virtue that you have from birth that is a result of virtue's deep conditioning.
Yeah, I mean, of the two collections, which one is it?
It's the collection of merit.
Yeah, there's the collection of merit and the collection of wisdom. Collection of merit causes what?
The form body.
Yeah, all the good deeds you ever do, amassed together, will someday force you to see yourself as a Buddha. That's the idea. That great mass of good deeds, that great mass of energy is called the collection of merit. And what's the other one? Collection of
wisdom.
That wisdom is not the one meant here. A lot of people, you know, I talked about the two collections, so on the homework they said, virtue root is those two. That's not the case. It's mainly the collection of merit. Mainly the cause for your form body. So if you cut your geta, If you destroyed your most basic virtues by which two actions?
Anger
at a bodhisattva or?
That's not believing in karma.
Yeah, lokta, wrong view, okay. Then why would you mainly be cheating yourself out of? Buddha.
Form body.
Looking like a Buddha.
You could still be a Buddha, but you couldn't look like a
Buddha. No, sorry, you have to look at it. All right. The omniscience of a Buddha, and it's not what we're talking about here. So don't give me both collections on that answer. Just the first one. Stillwell, give me the personality type for the person who does that kind of collection.
Someone who's intellectual. If you will clearly evaluate the idea, hold a conclusion, and sustain it.
Yeah, okay. They are intellectual rather than sensual type. And they are smart. And they're not smart. But they're capable of holding a sustained conviction. And that's what it takes to destroy that virtue. It's not just the occasional thought that might not be true. It's a strong conviction. A well thought out, well considered conviction. Let's see. Janet, why is an immediate deed called an immediate deed?
Because you'll feel the results in the next rebirth.
In the very next rebirth.
The very next rebirth.
And that's no other kind of birth between this and the next one. And that next birth is what?
Oh, if it's a bad deed, then it's hell, and it's the break of it. If you call it schism, then it's the lower hell.
Yeah, okay. Any one of the five will get you to hell. Must get you to hell. And then the worst one of the five must get you to lowest hell. But and any one of the other four could get you to lowest hell, but not necessarily. The schism always does. Alright, unless you do a purification. Which, by the way, the Abhidharma won't accept that last thing. Fran, the five great bad deeds in order. In order of worst to best. I mean, worst to least. What's the worst one of the five best? What's the five worst deeds? Fran, yeah. Yeah. Breaking up the monk. Historically, what? I guess so. You can have Genden, yeah. The idea of Genden, which is a quorum, applies to nuns also.
The next one is attempting to kill a Buddha.
Right. Right. Okay. In their order. All right. That's from worst to least. Okay. Four qualities that make a person to whom you give giving exceptional. And give an example for each one.
First one is type
of game,
between
him and the person who is suffering. Second one is person who's suffering,
it's exceptional to give something to someone.
Right, or sick,
like,
yeah,
sick. Third one is someone giving you someone who is giving you grandchildren as a parent.
Why parents?
So
I want to
teach you. Because they're giving you life, even if they do nothing else.
Yeah, okay. A lot of people say, oh, my mother was bad to me, or she beat me, or she left me, or it doesn't matter. In Buddhism, once they give you life, that qualifies them as an exceptional object, because with life you can attain nirvana. Without life you can't. That's okay, last one?
Is given to someone with high spiritual quality with the Dalai Lama, who doesn't need your
offer. Cool. Okay, take a quick break, and then we'll do a short thing on purification. Try to come back like in 10 minutes. I can finish you. It wasn't supposed to be part of this class. But since you know how karma works, you might be concerned about all the karma you collected in the past. I don't know. Nancy, where's Nancy? No. Hang on.
While you're waiting, can I make a real quick announcement? It seems like a lot of the tapes, or it seems like a fair number of tapes are gone, so if anybody's got the class tapes at home, can you bring them back so that they could stay in the library and other people could use them?
By the way, December 9th, 6:30 here, holiday party. I can get rid of all the bad comments I did hundreds of years ago and I don't remember anymore. Or even when I was young, I don't remember. Or even yesterday, I don't remember. There's this thing called Chishak. Chishak means general confession, blanket confession. And the monks have to do it every 2 weeks. And it's a very nice confession ceremony. It covers the bad deeds that you might have done. It says here, from time with no beginning up to the present moment. Okay. So it's a blanket confession. We believe that if you do it correctly, you can remove those bhaktas, or you can deactivate them. Okay. And we'll talk about how that works. It's not easy, because if it was easy, you know, you could just do whatever you want and then 5 minutes later confess it, right? It doesn't work that way. And then this is a translation of that, and there's a picture of the Buddha here. So I suggest you pull it out and keep it in your wallet, and every time you do a bad deed, you pull it out. Atisha used to carry a stupa. And he would be riding around Tibet on a horse, and every time he had a bad thought, he would get down off his horse, stop the whole procession, and go off somewhere and confess, you know, his thought. And, you know, other lamas used to keep black and white rocks in their pockets and move the rocks every time they had a bad thought. And then count the black rocks at the end of the day. You can keep a little, I keep a little thing in my pocket, a little diary, a little pocket thing, and every time I write it down. Just gotta track your progress. there's a thing in manufacturing, which I do, which if you're getting a lot of defects, you don't yell at the people. You don't say, cut down the defects. You say, could you please count them for me? Just count them. You don't have to fix anything. Just count them for me and give me a report every day. And then they fix it because they noticed it. And then they within 2 weeks, you don't have any defects. You never have to tell them not to do it. Just ask them to watch it. This confession has four parts. If the four parts aren't complete, it doesn't work.
Yeah. You
want the Tibetan? They're called the four forces. Sorry.
And you don't mind.
Okay, four forces. First force is foundation force. Some books describe this as the person that you offended, and it's either the Buddha or other living beings. Probably both. But the deepest interpretation of it is different. And the deepest interpretation is that the foundation force is refuge. Refuge means putting your faith in the Buddha and the Dhamma and Sangha for what's going to be able to help you out of this. What kind of faith is it? It's faith by knowing. The ultimate Dhamma, by the way, is exactly what we've just been talking about in this class. It's knowledge. Okay? It's refuge in knowledge. Right? It's not refuge in some big guy up there or anything else. The ultimate refuge is your own understanding of what's right and wrong and selflessness. So really, this is the state of refuge. It's the mental state of refuge. Which means, the ultimate Dharma refuge is understanding emptiness and karma. Okay? So that's the foundation force. It's called foundation because you've got to have some firm foundation. When you fall down, it takes something solid to get up from. And that's why it says when you fall down, meaning when you do some bad deed, you restore yourself, you stand back up by asserting your refuge. And that's the meaning of foundation. It's going for refuge. Going for refuge again. It's not some blind belief in some guy. It's understanding what happened. And that's refuge, because that's the only thing that will save you. Destruction force is this. It's called Namba-Sin-Jimba-Do. Namba-Sin-Jimba is a really nasty word in Tibet. Namba-Sin-Jimba doesn't mean just destruction. It means to rip something out of the ground, like it's what you do to a weed. It's the word for rape in Tibetan. It's a really forceful word. The word is very powerful, and it means to rip out the roots of something. Okay. Nambar sunjimbi, and that is regret. And regret is defined as follows: it's not this guilt complex, and it's not this fuzzy bad feeling. It's an intelligent knowledge that you have just screwed yourself. You have just caused yourself much suffering. And they say, the example they give in the scriptures is, there's three guys sitting in a bar, and they all order the same thing, and the bartender comes over and pours three glasses out of the same bottle, and they all down it. And then the first guy starts choking and run like this, and he falls over dead. And they all realize that the guy has poured out a bottle of poison by accident. And then the second guy starts to go like this, you know. And then the third guy starts to feel queasy. And it's the feeling of the third guy. Really, that's how the Lama Rinpoche says. It's the feeling he has that, oh my God, you know, I'm dead. You know, I'm really dead. And for you, it's an educated, intelligent, American Buddha who has understood all the theories of the mind-only school and Madhyamika's theory of emptiness and has studied karma carefully and knows damn well that you've just planted a bhakcha, you know, and you must experience the result of that bhakcha. Unless you do some incredible deed to purify it, you now know that you must experience that result, and you know how it was planted in everything, mainly through the perception of what you did. And you know you're going to have a result. And it's that, just that cold, calculated knowledge that you have just caused yourself much suffering. That's what destruction force is. Yeah, because that has a peculiar power to fix up the whole situation. If you really understand what you did, and you have a sincere feeling of, I think regret is a lousy word. I don't know, it's some kind of a sick feeling, you know. When the space shuttle blew up, the last thing on the tape recorder was like, It's like that. You know you're in trouble. You know as an educated Buddhist now, you know the process, you know what it happened, you know how many of the elements were present, you know what's going to happen, you know how it stays in your mind, and you realize that you did it. And you just feel bad. It was a compulsion that made you do it, and now you must experience that result. It's that cold knowledge that you're going to be experiencing that result. Okay. That's a jirpa, regret. The last one has a long word. Third one. Also, there's this other element which we talked about, of knowing how much it's going to hurt other people. And the ultimate form of that is that if you take longer to become a good person, for every day that you delay becoming a good person, you're influencing other people badly. You're messing up other people. You know, as long as you have your particular problem, which I know what mine is, you know what yours is, you're going to affect other people. So in a way, you're hurting other people also. As long as you delay your own perfection, you are hurting other people. One less Buddha around to help. Okay, restraint force is very simple. You just don't do it again. Now you see why it's so difficult to do a purification. Okay? And you see why you can't just do what you want the night before and the morning after pill, you know? You do this confession the next morning, everything's okay. I can do what I want tonight. Because as long as I don't die at night, you know, everything's okay in the morning if I just do a nice confession. It's not like that. Because if you have the restraining force, you know, if you have restrained yourself from doing it again, you're not doing that confession again for that particular deed. And now, and then the lineage instruction, you know, the instruction of all the lamas in the lineage is that, let's be frank, I mean, you can't stop, probably. We're like alcoholics, you know. I mean, you probably won't be able to stop completely doing that thing again. Because you're supposed to work on the thing that you do the worst, you know, the thing that you do the most, the thing that you're really out of control on. And frankly, you and I know you're going to do it again. So the lamas say, and it's part of it's a very, very profound part of the instruction, set a time limit. Okay, so it's restraint force with a time limit.
Okay.
So they
say,
well,
you have to do that or it's recommended because of
recommended. Probably you won't be able to stop it for the rest of your life. I mean, if it was, you know, an abortion or something like that, and now you know it's wrong, and you're not... That's the kind of thing you can say, I'm never going to do that again as long as I live. But if it's something like yelling at someone, or me looking at a girl on the street or something, I'm not supposed to. I know I'll probably do it again. I have to set a time limit. You can't keep your awareness that tightly for a long period of time. It's almost impossible. If it's a slight thing that you're doing that's very easy to do, it's very important to set a short time limit and swear that you won't do it for that period. Because if you break that, then what happens?
You lied.
You lied. You collected number four.
So you,
I mean, just
keep
pile the bad deed on top of the first.
Sorry. You just keep renewing it then.
You have to keep renewing it. But these are for things that are chronic with you, and in all honesty and in all frankness, you know that you can't stop right away.
When you say a time limit, I thought you meant you say I'll stop in six months.
No, not like that. That would be nice. Maybe that would be a better one. No, you say, look, and the book says 1 year, 1 month, 1 day, 1 hour. I have had the same thought occur before I finished my confession ceremony. that's very depressing, you know. So you know, I have to set a 30-second limit. But it's important to set one that's realistic. And, you know, like exercise or any other thing that you do with practice, you know, make it longer. Build it up as long as you can. But be
be tight and be very pure. But pick a time period in which you can truly keep it purely, and then you'll get used to being pure. And that's the whole idea. If you don't do that, it's not a confession. And that's why you can't just keep doing whatever you want to do and then next morning confess it and everything's okay.
So
people accuse Buddhists, Mahayanists, of thinking that. It's not like that.
So
if you're doing it repeatedly, then you're not improving and you're not doing your confession. It's not working.
Yeah. So are you saying that if you get to, you set a time limit of like, I'm not going to do this for 10 minutes, and you're successful in that, that's a successful purification?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you set it for 30 seconds and you're successful and you do that, it's successful.
If it were an honest maximum that you could do. Reasonable maximum. Okay.
What does it mean,
purification? What does it mean, purification? Okay. You have to experience some kind of result, but it's much less. You are knocking out the table legs of those karmic past elements as opposed to karma elements. You know, you're knocking out a lot of the intention, a lot of the samba part, a lot of the motivation part is being ripped out, and that seed is getting much less powerful. They say if you're supposed to go to hell, you get a bad backache or something like that. And practitioners who are really good at this, and I've seen that in India, you know, certain places, people do a teaching on purification for 6 weeks or something. So they're all really working hard on it. Everyone gets sick, you know, some guy died, you know. It's like, really, you may experience some minor problems after this, and that's a good sign. It's a good sign. You're wearing off something that would have been much worse.
Michael?
Yes.
Is there any time when, let's say, if what you said heard of this particular sentient being like a person, is it important to apologize to that particular person?
It helps a lot. It's part of the thing you told. It helps a lot. It helps a lot.
That is part of the first one?
Yeah. In the sense of them being the object. It helps a lot. It really helps a lot. Yeah. Okay. Number four. Antidote for it? Oh. I keep thinking of Tibetan. Okay, antidote is like this. There's six antidotes. Antidote means you do something to make up for it. Okay, you undertake some concrete action to make up for it. I remember we have a guy in our community down in New Jersey who was in Vietnam, and he was an infantryman. He says he sprayed jungles with machine guns, and he doesn't know if he killed anybody or not. He doesn't remember shooting someone, you know, and seeing them fall down, but he was in firefights, and he thinks he may have hit people he doesn't know. So he asked Rinpoche what to do. And Rinpoche knew that his father was keeping two sheep with the intention of killing them and eating them. So he said, get the two sheep from your father and feed them until they die of natural causes. And these sheep lived like 16 years, you know. And that's like a Nyamuka, okay? Alright, so they are like this. The first one is reciting the names of the Buddha. Reciting a Buddhist name.
Any of these six? All these six?
Any one of these six. And I'll explain. Some of them are more powerful than others. And there is a confession which I didn't give you, which is a lot longer, which is called the 35 Buddhas, and maybe you've seen that. And you recite the names of the Buddhists that have lived in the past.
Is it more powerful?
It would be nice if you had it, but I think you also, as an American in this society, you have to do the ones that are the most powerful. So you have to have ones that are... I could have given you a five-page thing, but then you wouldn't use it. Okay. Second one is mantra. Recite mantra. We talked about how a mantra works. Do you remember? Of all places, it was where? Do you remember? Of all places, it was in the logic text of Dharmakirti. And he said, a mantra works because of two reasons must be present for a mantra to work. It must come from a holy source. The person who wrote the mantra or invented the mantra must be a holy being. And then secondly, and most importantly, the person who recites the mantra must be moral, must be a pure person. You know, the person who recites it must really have intentions of noble intentions. And good morality. I like that. He was explaining how mantras work. Not like it's a holy word, and if you say it, but you're a cool person, it's good work. All right. Number three is to study or read the scriptures. Okay. You got plenty of that stuff. the fourth one, which is the most powerful one, is to meditate on emptiness insofar as you understand it presently. It doesn't matter if your understanding of emptiness is very, very crude. I told you last week about Kappa, right? I was reading his biography, and the first time he met Manjushri, he wasn't good enough to see him, but he was good enough to ask questions through another person. And he asked Manjushri, how's my view of emptiness? And Manjushri says, terrible. And then he says, well, mine more Madhuri's Prasanna Sutra and more. Why did that work? Why is it such a good antidote?
Conditions you for next time?
It's the only thing which can remove your tendency to do anything permanently. It's the only thing. It's the only that understanding can remove. You can try all the tricks you want to be a good person. And you can try all these mental gymnastics and acrobatics, which you must try as a temporary measure. But you cannot remove your negative emotions permanently that way. It's impossible. Fifth one is making offerings to a Buddha image or...
Do you mean actual offering? What about offering your goodies? Is that
the highest kind of Buddhist offering. It's well known. It's called the Gupichipa. The highest kind of Buddhist offering is to succeed in your practice, to do what your Lama taught you. You know, if you go to work and someone screams at you tomorrow and you keep your patience, that's the highest form of offering, according to Buddhism. Better than all the money or.
But what happens when you're sitting down and say, I'll offer all of the things, all the good deeds that I've done?
That's rejoicing, and that's a powerful good deed. You can offer that too. That's a great offering. You know, some people interpret that to mean they should never go to a temple and offer anything. It doesn't mean that either. You should have to do both. You do everything you can. And the last one is to Kusubla Temba. Kusubla Temba means to use holy images. And I'm, to tell you the truth, I'm not very clear what it means. And I have to ask. I guess it means to speak, you know, like you could confess in front of the image of the Buddha.
Touch yourself in meditation, perhaps?
Could be. It says to use holy images. And I tell you the truth, I don't know exactly. I think it, normally they say it's very good to confess in front of the image of the Buddha.
Well, Michael, you said when we do bad things, to take out the sheet of paper.
Which you've already lost.
No.
By the way, Marie Placide has agreed to do a little thing that you can really fit in your wallet. What do you call it? Plastic covered thing.
Oh, laminated.
Flip open and just, you got a little Buddha there and you just. Yeah. I think that'd be good for us.
Oh, nice. This you could do anywhere, you know, work.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole. That's why we did it on. You should think anyway, she just doesn't do it anymore.
What you're saying is we can't just read this and have a purification. It won't work.
Right.
Well, if you read it carefully, you'll see most of these elements are in the prayer.
But reading is not enough.
No, reading is not enough. It will not work without these four.
Feeling it.
Especially without restraining yourself in the future. That's why, you know, if a person's doing this general confession over and over again and he's still a lousy person, he's not improving, it will not work. It's not working. It's not removing the bhaja. If you do it, it does remove, according to Mahayana, according to the highest teachings of Buddhism, it does remove the energy. And it's important when you finish to believe that it's finished. You know, it's important to think to yourself, that's it, I'm clean. That's very important, especially as you die. You know, I'm not kidding. As you die, you know, hopefully you've got this chakra in your mind or close by, and you do it. And we believe that the Catholic thing about last rites is correct. We believe that it's very important that as you die to believe that you're pure.
Can you explain what the 10
known
virtues are and the 5 great
ones? Oh, now this took us 6 weeks to do, and you can ask any of these Buddhist scholars in this room have just finished this course on that.
Michael,
there's
two texts, but I'm not sure if that's
what
you refer to.
The Kempo
and the Lopan,
the Gates and the Vow? Yeah, Kempo and Lopan is a little bit special. You know, Kempo, most people think, means avid. Kempo, literally, in the Vinaya, it means the person who grants you the vow. And Lopan, in the Vinaya, is the assistant to him. So this part is for monks mostly. By extension, it can be the person who gave you any of your vows, bodhisattva vows or secret vows. Okay.
Is that the same Kenpo and Kenpo?
That's the same one as in Ken Rinpoche. Kenpo has like three different meanings. One is the abbot of a monastery. One is the person who grants a monk his full vows. And then the third meaning is you can reach a certain point where you are like reincarnation.
Yeah. How do
we
do this then?
Yeah, let me go in order. Go ahead,
Connie. Somebody had mentioned the Vajrasattva meditation, which I presume is the same thing, or a similar thing, or it's achieving the same result, or for the same purpose.
More powerful.
That's more powerful than
this. Yeah.
So in other words, to...
But this is a basic thing.
I understand that, but if you have a certain amount of time every day that you allocate to that,
yeah,
it would be a mistake to cut that in half.
No, right, that's much better.
Okay.
Much better. If you've had that initiation and you know how to do it, that's much better. They're actually, what do you call it? You know.
One goes into the
next. They're like, they go together. I wouldn't say it as either or. I kind of like that.
So whenever they talk about, you know, they say do 21 recitations of Vajrasattva mantra to purify your karma, that's not really correct. But that's just a recitation I'm talking about.
That's number four.
Yeah.
But if it's not accompanied by yantra, it cannot work.
So it doesn't really have any effect, really.
No, it's great. It's always good.
How do you use this?
When you do a bad deed, I mean a particularly bad one, pull it out of your purse and recite it. And get these other three ideas in your
mind. But if you're working, you can have the other ones.
Write it on the back. Write these four on the back. And then as you read it, think of those four. And that's all.
Okay, you can add, like you said, Abhijit.
Yeah, do it as soon as you can. Don't wait till you go home. You might die in the subway. It seriously is the game of not dying with it on you. And you don't know when you're going to die. So, you know, I always tell people, go to the bathroom. Nobody stops you from going to the bathroom. They just wonder what you're doing in this stall so long, you know.
You can add the image of the Buddha, Michael.
You got one right there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Quickly, any different emphasis between confession for lay people and monk
moments? Okay. We have more responsibility. It's worse for us. All right. So please use it. And also I want to say, you did a very good job. I know it's late. I know when I rarely work a full day, I know how hard it is to come here, and I admire what you did. I really admire it, because you're coming here, there's no degree to speak of, at least they come like 6 months later, and you're not getting any financial benefit out of it, you're not getting famous, no worldly benefit out of it, and you're coming here after work. I know it's difficult, and I know everyone in New York doesn't have much time. And you're studying these things out of some good bhakti you have. And I admire it, and I think it's a great thing. And I'm very happy. It's excellent. You must do some regimen. You must keep some kind of log. You must have some daily check. None of this will work. It will all fade away. You know that. You know, make it part of your... If it's not a practice, you won't do it, and there won't be much benefit to doing this whole class. So you have to really... keep up the habit of doing something every morning and make confession upon it. And then you'll just be happier. The side effect is, I mean, even in this life, it's much more pleasant to be a person.
This is the end of Class 11. You have been listening to How Karma Works with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.